Welcome back to our next episode of Joint Ventures with me, Dr. Hesbos, and my colleague, as always, Dr. Jackal Arnolds. Today, we are going to discuss coming-of-age story for B-cell and therapies across different rheumatic diseases. It's going to be almost 20 years since first B-cell targeted therapy, rituximab, has been approved for treatment initially for rheumatoid arthritis. What appeared to be a very promising start at the beginning has turned out to be a much more complicated story over the past two decades. While additional licensing has been gained for ANCA-associated vasculitis, the majority of rituximab use has remained off label, reflecting ongoing uncertainty in the supporting evidence. And this is as complex, I think, as it gets in rheumatology. So we thought just two of us will not be enough to cover this topic. So we have drafted in someone who has spent all of their professional career helping the rest of the world to understand about lupus and about B cells, and that is Dr. Lucy Carter.
Yeah, it's my absolute privilege to introduce her, Lucy Carter. So Lucy and I go back quite a long way. She's a consultant rheumatologist at Newcastle upon Tyne NHS Foundation Trust and an honorary clinical senior lecturer at Newcastle University. On a more personal note, Lucy and I go back very far. We first worked together when I was an SHO in Oxford. Many years have passed, job titles have changed, hairs have greyed, and in my case, sometimes disappeared altogether. But one thing has remained fairly constant, that Lucy is still teaching me about lupus. And it's an absolute privilege to have her on the show. So welcome, Lucy.
Thank you, Lucy. Thank you.
So,
Thanks very much.
I think probably the best place to start with this is a sort of more basic question, just talking about, you know, before we get into specific drugs or trials, just why have B cells always looked like such an attractive therapeutic target in lupus and Sjögren's and other diseases? I wonder if you could just start basic and we'll build on from there.
Well, I mean, I think the instinctive answer we'd all reach for is the presence of autoantibodies. They are characteristic of many of the diseases that we treat. They're part of the informed diagnosis, and they may or may not have varying degrees of a pathogenic activity, but they're definitely there. And we can infer from that there's autoreactivity in the B cell compartment, and we know that B cells are potent effector cells for various reasons, and so it become instinctive targets, and that's across many autoantibody positive diseases, being very polyclonal diseases like lupus to very kind of monoclonal diseases, maybe more like ANCA vasculitis, but all those things apply.
And Rihad, you were saying, so will you give us an idea of some of the story from going from, you said, almost 20 years ago today, sort of where we started and where we're going to?
Yeah, because it seems like the story has been quite rough, isn't it? Like, first of all, there is this discrepancy between what we evidence base is, and between real world evidence. We all feel quite comfortable using rituximab to treat lupus, myositis, but actually the trial data is not really there to support that.
Yeah. So, I mean, lupus has faced, in particular, has faced a huge progression in kind of trial design and understanding of clinical endpoints and understanding how to optimize the kind of the delta of treatment arms versus placebo by kind of refining patient selection, enforcing steroid taper, minimizing background therapies or fluctuations in background therapies, particularly the glucocorticoids, and also just, you know, selecting the right patient cohort and verifying that you're treating active disease. So that is something that's evolved hugely, specifically in lupus, and probably trial design was responsible for a lot of failed therapeutics over the years, and probably we'd look back and say was contributory to the failures of the major rituximab clinical trials, Explorer and Luna. So that has progressed a long, long way. But there are some practical kind of reasons why we don't see full efficacy with rituximab. But the adoption of it in clinical practice, I suppose we are all practicing in the UK, and I think we are kind of a little bit singular in the UK compared to the rest of Europe about just how well adopted rituximab is in clinical practice. It's not really so elsewhere in the world. But I think, well, a lot of it came from old colleagues of mine, David Eisenberg, one of my mentors, in UCLH, very early adopters, brought through, you know, a clear data collection, assembled cohorts, built a real world evidence base, which allowed us in the UK to access the drug through NHS clinical commissioning.
I think when I was thinking about the topic kind of broader today, for general rheumatologists, when we talk about B cell therapies, we think automatically about rituximab, and that has been for the past 20 years. So what are we kind of thinking about how we can target B cells apart from belimumab? But that has been, it's more niche, but that generally has been only rituximab. So we are looking at very broad kind of targeting cells just with one agent and judging the kind of efficacy of that. I think that has probably played a role in this as well, isn't it? And also things are changing, what we will touch upon later.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really fascinating time to be talking about this because we have been reliant on rituximab as a B-cell depleting agent for a long, long time. And with the expansion of the therapeutic pipeline that we have seen in the last 5 years or more, 2030 practice is going to look very, very different in terms of the therapies available to us. Our kind of repertoire of therapies is going to be considerably different. And we're kind of talking about the first targeted therapies coming online for Sjogren's, which is just transformative. And it kind of speaks to how our understanding of the pathology in the B cell pool across these diseases, let's say primarily lupus, but also the other rheumatic diseases, has really informed some very rational therapeutic drug design, rational drug design. And I think that's very powerful. The rituximab had really just been extracted from the lymphoma field and deployed, whereas some of what we're seeing now is very focused on what are the pathogenic components of the B cell pool in these diseases. And you've mentioned belimumab has its approval for lupus and only lupus. And that is interesting. And I think perhaps people don't perhaps know quite so much about the mechanism and where BAFF plays, how BAFF plays into these disease states. I think it's probably worth touching on. Like BAFF being B cell activating factor, being one of the key sustaining mechanisms of the B cell pool. It's there and it really sustains the B cell survival from the transitional state of transitional B cells onwards into the mature phase. Acts via primarily the BAFF receptor, but can bind TACI and BCMA as well. And really, if you remove BAFF, if you knock it out in a mouse, you get a completely B cell hypoplastic state, right? They're basically without their B cells. And if you overexpress it in a mouse, you get a B cell pool that looks like lupus, looks very autoreactive. So you kind of get this picture building up where if you've got this excess state of BAFF exposure, which we do see in Sjogren's disease and we do see in lupus, you're tilting the B cell pool towards an autoreactive state. You're permitting this excessive survival of these autoreactive B cells and these excessive autoantibodies. So that's a rational therapeutic target, and that's where belimumab is fitting. But it's such an interesting thing that it's there to maintain our B cell pool. And so when we treat with rituximab and when we deplete B cells, the natural physiological, the homeostasis is for B cells to be repopulated. You deplete something, the homeostasis is to put it back. And BAFF does that. And Joe Cambridge's work at UCLH demonstrated as soon as you deplete B cells with rituximab, whatever your disease state is, be it rheumatoid or lupus, you get a big surge in BAFF levels and it's repopulating, it's driving that repopulation. And we've kind of just said that BAFF tilts you towards auto-reactivity. So one of the things that I did quite early on in my career when I was at UCH with Professor Michael Ehrenstein, who another great figure in my career, was coming from an observation where you treat with rituximab in lupus, primarily, we were studying, and you achieve a clinical response and you deplete the B cells. And then an observation coming through in a few patients where they go on to flare after their rituximab treatment and after their treatment effect. And in fact, that flare sort of looked worse in terms of its antibody titers than the flare before. Mm-hmm. And leading to that hypothesis that, well, the BAFF, we've pushed the BAFF levels up, we've depleted and the BAFF levels have risen in response to the B cell depletion. And we know they're kind of tilting us towards autoreactivity. So are they, is the BAFF actually responsible for driving the reemergence of the disease after you've depleted with rituximab? Mm-hmm. And we did some experiments in archived serum looking at the point where people flare when they've been treated with rituximab and found that that pretty much was the correlation. The more their BAFF was rising, the more they were bringing back these pathogenic autoantibodies, these dsDNA binding antibodies. And so it gave this picture that you've depleted and you've got this surge in BAFF and it's repopulating and it's driving your B cell pool towards an autoreactive kind of skew to it. And kind of thinking, well, actually, it's not enough to just deplete the B cells. You've really got to focus on what's coming back after you've repopulated.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's that concept of you can deplete down as deeply as you like in, you know, with rituximab or with more modern anti-CD20s, but you need to then address the conditions by which you grow back. It's like clearing a path of weeds and then not putting any weed killer down. It's that sort of approach to it that you need to address.
Yeah. And depth of depletion definitely seems like it's important. Well, it is critically important, and we're learning that more and more from the CAR-T data. But certainly we know that rituximab is not the best B-cell depleter.
Yeah,
it's got a lot of limitations to it by its mechanism of action, by kind of the genetics of an individual, about kind of propensity for it to be immunogenic because it's a chimeric antibody. Various reasons why it doesn't deplete deeply enough, and you leave this kind of reservoir of B cell pathology that is there and primed to be a kind of reignited and reemerge after the depletion. So definitely depth of depletion. The more you've cleared, the more likely you are to be able to reconstitute your B cell pool with cells that are just much more normal. They're much more physiological.
Yeah. And then, so you mentioned about depth of depletion. So obviously we're talking about being CD20 targeted therapies. And we know the CD19 has much more broader kind of target, but then the I can't remember the name of the drug, but that was stopped after the phase two. CD19 target that didn't really show any efficacy at all. So do you think that the problem has been that with the target, with how rituximab works, not being able to achieve that, the depth of the depletion?
Yeah, I mean, it depends where you think your pathogenic reservoir is, right? Because it's not expressed on long-lived plasma cells and which, you know, can reside in the bone marrow very well indefinitely, should we say, and so if plasma, long-lived plasma blasts and plasma cells are what you think is the origin of your antibody or your disease, then CD20 is not the target. I think that actually what we've seen is that you can achieve effective therapeutic depletion with CD20 targeting, but there are mechanisms about how rituximab works that mean it's not really quite optimal. And I think, well, we've now got obinutuzumab available through its approvals for lupus nephritis, and some really exciting data recently out in the New England Journal from the Allegory trial in systemic lupus, non-renal lupus, showing that a newer generation of an anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody, same target as rituximab, but with some glycoengineering and some design, is able to achieve a more consistent and deeper B-cell depletion. So Venkat Reddy showed in vitro assays that it was a superior depleter, and we've seen in tissue sampling that following rituximab versus following obinutuzumab is the deeper depleter. I don't think it's that CD20 is necessarily the wrong target, but I think it hasn't, until now, it hasn't really been well optimized in terms of the antibody.
And I think that obviously the Allegri data is the standalone data here. It's obviously the most interesting, but just to feather our own nest, Lacey, we've obviously got case series data where we can see that even in those who do fail to respond to rituximab, these secondary non-depletion non-responders, we've still seen efficacy with obinutuzumab in these cases, albeit only in case series data. So it does suggest that there is something.
I think most of us wouldn't hesitate to use that as an alternative if we've been treating patients with rituximab. And what you've described, Jack, is those patients who've apparently done okay on rituximab and then had some sort of infusion reaction, usually demonstrated that they still have circulating B cells, still have residual disease. And I think most of that is all pointing to anti-drug antibody.
Immunogenicity and things. Obviously, it's an exciting time to be in the field. I think it's for those of us. I just wanted to circle back for those of us who maybe aren't familiar with the history of the data in rituximab in these cases. So obviously, Lucy mentioned two trials there in lupus: Explorer and Luna, both which failed to meet their primary endpoint. Explorer in non-renal lupus, Luna in proliferative lupus nephritis. It is Sjögren's Awareness Month coming up, and we also have a couple of failures in Sjögren's, which is probably worth mentioning in the context of this. So the two biggest trials, probably Tractis and Tears, both trials which failed to meet their primary endpoints for a number of reasons. But both showed some secondary signals. So, you know, Tears did show some improvement in salivary flow rate in patients with residual gland function, but the whole trial as a whole was negative. And there were some positive, you know, signals in Tractis too, but a few problems. I just wondered, Lucy, do you think that Sjögren's is perhaps the most purely B-cell mediated disease that we treat? I know that's a little bit of a loaded question, but probably worth discussing.
It's very B-cell expanded disease, isn't it? They're in a kind of chronically activated state. And we recognize that hypergammaglobulinemia of Sjögren's, which speaks to a very B-cell expanded disease. But I think it might be. IgG4 related disease probably needs an honourable mention, doesn't it?
Probably needs to feature in that discussion, I think, somewhat. I think that's probably fair.
And then I do wonder about lupus, because what's going on there is very polyclonal. It's not single antigen. It's not single epitope. It's not one autoantibody. It's many. So that kind of says that you haven't just got one clone of abnormal B cells. You've got many. So I think for different reasons, you could argue the case either way. But I might lean towards Sjögren's. Yeah.
And I think we discussed that there's been issues with endpoints and trial design and things that, you know, procedural rather than drug mechanistic reasons why rituximab wasn't positive in SLE data. And I think the same's probably seen, you know, can be argued for the Sjögren's data. You know, a few reasons we've had issues with endpoints. I suppose there are a couple of mechanistic things I just wanted to touch on. Obviously, we know that peripheral B-cell depletion with rituximab is rapid and effective, but tertiary lymphoid structures and depletion within these structures is perhaps less penetrant. And I think that is something that may have driven perhaps some of the disappointing results in Sjögren's. And I think the other thing to sort of mention really is that in these patients who have chronic glandular inflammation in the context of Sjögren's, there is a degree of long-term damage that perhaps persists even beyond correction of the ongoing inflammatory insults. You've got people with symptoms like Sika and you know, other symptoms that, that just will not return to the norm in spite of correction of those things. So I think that that's probably worth noting as well, just as another spanner in the works, really, for rituximab and perhaps why it wasn't as effective as it could have been.
And that's what the predominantly Sjögren's trials have been focusing on, isn't it? The primary endpoints have been fatigue, dryness, rather than extra glandular kind of manifestations of disease.
And I think that's fair in the sense that these are outcomes that really matter to patients. Yeah. These are things that affect them on a day-to-day basis, but it's just complicated by that whole damage or active inflammation question that is prevalent across, you know, rheumatology, wherever you're working, really, trying to tease out what's chronic damage and what's active disease.
Yeah, there's some interesting data come through from the Regency obinutuzumab lupus nephritis study that I think it was presented by Anna Malvar at ACR last year, maybe? Where there was a subset of patients who had obinutuzumab for lupus nephritis in Regency had a around about week 76 or something like that re-biopsy. And that was really to understand, is the B-cell depletion being deep enough to reach the diseased nephron? And the answer was yes. Mm. And it was so much so that actually in very identifiable non-responders, they could see that they had achieved B cell depletion in the kidney, which then potentially leads you to see that you've had histological remission. You can see B cell depletion and you can see resolution of the activity index on the rebiopsy, but they were a proteinuria non-responder, because actually what you're measuring in the proteinuria is partly damage, but partly not even damage, partly hyperfiltration. So it really depends on what you're measuring. And some of that data might suggest that the Regency non-responders were in fact histological responders but had proteinuria from different mechanisms.
Okay. Absolutely. So, I mean, we've spoken about sort of the renal data in obinutuzumab. I think you briefly touched on Alacrit, Lucy. Just for those who weren't present, you know, with the release of that data relatively recently, although a couple of months ago now, really. So this is obinutuzumab in systemic lupus, extrarenal disease, and showed some really interesting results. I mean, improvements in SRI4 response and BICLA response, significant improvements in both. The one that really stood out to me was the steroid reduction between the two arms. So 80%, you know, versus 54% in placebo, which is obviously very interesting from our perspective and from what you see in day-to-day practice. This is obviously relatively new data. We'll see how this approach, but I mean, how do you think that's going to move the needle in terms of how we're managing extrarenal lupus?
I mean, I think in the UK, it'll do what we've been reaching for, B-cell depletion in the UK as a therapy for lupus quite readily. This will now be an evidence-based, phase three evidence-based option for doing that. And I think that the steroid sparing activity is really critical to how we interpret trials now. More and more we see that steroid exposure is core to long-term outcomes. You know, it's critical to the accrual of damage. It has an impact on morbidity and mortality. So proactive steroid reduction in trials and maintenance of low dose, achieving low dose as maintenance, 5 or below in the EULAR target, is just essential. So that steroid sparing activity of any therapeutic that we're looking at now, it should not be underestimated.
Obinutuzumab is fully humanized monoclonal antibody. That's correct, isn't it? So we can expect then, and we would not anticipate really anti-drug autoantibody production, what is a significant issue with rituximab.
Yeah, lower. You'd imagine lower. I mean, it's humanized, isn't it? I'm not aware of any real data looking at anti-drug antibody formation. Like, we know that anti-drug antibody differs between disease states. Yeah. So lupus patients are really proactive formers of anti-drug antibodies against rituximab. They don't always impact the efficacy of the drug. You can mount that response and it doesn't necessarily have a neutralizing effect. But certainly, lupus patients are very predisposed to forming anti-drug antibodies, you'd imagine it's going to be lower. Mm-hmm. I guess we'll see.
Yes. Yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting. I mean, obviously, we talk about this in a resource-rich environment, you know, where we're currently practicing. But it's interesting to see where rituximab will fit into this in the context of obinutuzumab now. So where that's going to fit in terms of the therapeutic approach. Are we going to, you know, are we going to continue to use that? Are we going to, you know, where is that going to sit? And I don't know that I necessarily know the answer to that, to be honest. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, and I guess the more therapy advances we have, I think you and I touch on this often enough, Jack, about where the advanced therapies sit and where they separate the global north from the global south. Yes. So I think that rituximab exists will still be of value, and even if it is superseded in many kind of high income health systems.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just wanted to a little bit touch upon how do you think how much of significant and rapid expansion of CAR T-based therapies have driven us to really a little bit rethink our existing B-cell targeting therapies, what we have. Do you think that has played a role and trying to think about different concepts, about different use of already existing treatments?
Yeah, I mean the CAR T data from Erlangen has been nothing short of spectacular, and demonstrating a really clear concept that deep depletion can lead to very physiological B cell repopulation and lead to enduring remission. I guess that, you know, that's emerged against the context of our only comparator B-cell therapy that predated that in regular use was really rituximab. And so now we have to ask the question of how much, it's clearly superior, how much more superior is it to obinutuzumab and the other emerging B-cell therapies, and where does it fit in a single patient journey? And who are the right candidates for it and when? It's just the big unresolved area for that.
I mean, that's the question that we've discussed a few times, Lucy, isn't it? Is that where do you go if your patient fails CAR T-cell therapy currently?
Yeah.
It is difficult to conceive of the direction. Obviously, you do need to be judicious in when you're using that, because it does narrow your options in terms of trial inclusion in very complex patients as well. So it's an interesting question, isn't it? And it's one that's probably going to become a bit more commonly are.
Again, I think, you know, the number of phase one CAR T therapies that have been registered is vast. There's huge amount of venture capital gone into it. And I don't know how we're gonna work that out actually right now.
No, I don't think I have the answer for that. I'm sure it'll be a question that I'd ask you about at some point in the future as well. Fair enough. So I think that's probably a reasonable place to sort of pause where we are. So, you know, obviously this first episode of two, we've sort of established the framework. We've looked at where we started with rituximab, why B cells were such a sort of juicy target to start, where we've come to with B cell depletion with obinutuzumab and some of the Allegri data and where that's left us. And I think in the second part, we're sort of going to follow on from what Lucy mentioned earlier about talking about depletion and then the environment that exists beyond depletion and how that affects sustained remission in these diseases, and touch on some of the newer therapies and in the context of Sjögren's Awareness Month, ianalumab, in the context of Sjögren's, which has given us a positive phase 3 trial finally in Sjögren's disease. So very exciting. So thanks, Lucy Rehards. Thank you. And we'll be back in part 2.